You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 2nd of May 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme... As clashes continue across American campuses, Congress looks to counter rising anti-Semitism, but are they taking the right approach? In Kazakhstan, millions are tuning in to the trial of a former government minister accused of murdering his wife. Beyond the spectacle, could the case be a game changer for domestic violence in the country? And it's Thursday, which means we'll have our global countdown.
Yes, indeed, Vinny. It's all gezellig here, because today we're looking at the top five songs in the Netherlands.
Plus, the deteriorating security situation in Ecuador and the latest business news too. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. As police and pro-Palestinian protesters continue to clash on campuses across the United States, the House of Representatives has passed an anti-Semitism awareness bill with bipartisan support. The bill's author says it will, quote, provide for the consideration of a definition of anti-Semitism set by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance for the enforcement of federal anti-discrimination laws concerning education programs or activities. However, several organizations, including the American Civil Liberties Union, have criticized the bill for possibly chilling free speech by incorrectly equating criticism of the Israeli government with anti-Semitism. To discuss this, I'm joined now by Julie Norman, Deputy Director of the UCL Center on U.S. Politics. Julie, thank you for speaking with us. Firstly, what do you make of this attempt by Congress to pass an anti-Semitism bill? Is it needed?
Well, thanks, Vinny. I would say, obviously, in this moment right now in the United States with the Gaza war, with the attention to the protests on college campuses, there are many who do feel this bill is necessary. They see a rise in anti-Semitism. They see an increase in these kinds of, actions and statements. With that said, I think that many others feel that and anti-Semitism is already prohibited through our anti-discrimination laws. There are already measures in place that are supposed to protect against that. And they see this bill as perhaps taking things too far by seeming to include some measure that include criticism of Israel under that definition of anti-Semitism.
And how dangerous is this conflagration of criticism of Israel and its leadership with anti-Semitism, particularly for Jewish people itself, who, you know, might have absolutely no connection with Israel, have never visited, don't sort of support the government in any shape or form?
Absolutely. I think it's very important to distinguish between criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism, criticism of the Jewish people. I think those are two very separate things that most people do delineate between, and I would say most protesters also delineate between. Unfortunately, we've seen some blurring of those lines, and unfortunately that has obviously happened, you know, not only in the United States, but around the world as well. And I would say that trying to put a definition, though, that that includes criticism of Israel under the definition of anti-Semitism for most people is an abrogation of free speech. And I would note that even the definition that they're drawing from, the author of that definition has said he didn't want that to be put into law. He didn't want to be a legal form. It's supposed to be a working definition. And that was just the Israel part was just one of several examples given of what anti-Semitism might look like.
Would it make more sense, perhaps, to put efforts into making sure that in the education system there is, you know, teachings about anti-Semitism, about the history of the Middle East? Would that perhaps be a better place to start with all this?
Sure. And that's what many in Congress were supporting. And I would say, you know, Congress people who themselves are quite pro-Israel and across the spectrum. There's another bipartisan bill that Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader, has been promoting, essentially trying to do that, to have more attention to anti-Semitism education in colleges and secondary schools, and to try and, you know, build awareness that way rather than expanding the definition in a legal way that could, you know, presumably allow to increase crackdowns on some of the speech and protests that we've seen.
Some Democrats have accused Republicans of trying to set a political trap to divide them. Is this issue, do you think, going to be weaponized increasingly in the election?
Well, I would say, you know, in any politics, the idea of something that unites your side and divides the other is usually where people go in for the focus. And we're seeing that now. And, you know, this bill, too, I would say, you know, it did split Democrats. The majority of Democrats did vote for it, even as many voted against. It really was quite bipartisan. And so I feel like the Republicans will push on this, but even without them, this is something that is already dividing the Democratic Party. And we're seeing that play out across the United States right now.
If anyone's watching a TV news channel right now, they'll be seeing live pictures coming out from Los Angeles, where police are moving in on one of these protests. I mean, we are coming now to the end of the university terms. Do you think that we could see a sort of summer of action, perhaps even targeting both campaigns and the party conferences in the summer when it comes to, you know, if there isn't a ceasefire in the offing soon, that this could be a heavy part of the election campaign?
Absolutely, Vinny. I mean, we're seeing it right now on college campuses while terms are in session. Some of that will continue, but I think you're exactly right that this is going to transfer out even further. We have the conventions, of course. Those are already usually, you know, sites where protests take place. And I think this summer, especially for the Democrats, especially in Chicago, there's going to be a lot of continued protests and demonstrations as long as the war is still continuing.
And you're someone very used to university campuses. I mean, what is it about them that has really seen this issue take hold, not just in America, but campuses here in the UK as well, perhaps not to the same extent? But there are rising tensions across them. And in particular, you know, Jewish students have said that they're not feeling safe on many campuses.
Absolutely. I mean, this is obviously an issue that resonates with not just students, but many individuals, and is obviously very deeply felt. And it's one that universities are really struggling to ensure that all their students feel heard, feel protected, and are also, you know, trying to protect free speech at the same time. So this is it's a bit of a juggling act to try and ensure across that. But we have seen some universities, I think, doing it better than others. I think, you know, again, many of the students have been, you know, very, very open to different kinds of ways of dealing with this as well. But this is something that is certainly escalated more quickly than most universities, I think, were quite ready to handle this year.
And finally, are you and other academics worried about the level of intervention there's been from very senior politicians in what are effectively, you know, private universities in the United States, trying to really kind of bully, you know, directors of these universities out of their positions and sort of weigh in to the rules that they have and, you know, the speakers at their commencements and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think this is a worry where, again, I think you have a lot of students, most well-intentioned, who are really caught between two, I would say, political extremes and are somewhat being, you know, used, so to speak, by people from the extremes of different sides. And that's something that happens all the time, but I think especially in an election year and especially around an issue as fraught as this, it's something that unfortunately is something we've come to expect. But again, I would say there's, you know, a lot of agency from many of these student groups as well. And I think many of them are aware of being caught in between and are trying to push back against that themselves.
Dr. Julie Norman, thank you very much. Now here's Carlos Arevalo with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. Hundreds of helmeted police have descended onto the campus of the University of California in Los Angeles, preparing to clear out a pro-Palestinian protest camp that had been attacked the previous night by pro-Israel supporters. The impending crackdown at UCLA is the latest flashpoint for mounting tensions on U.S. college campuses. Protests over Israel's conduct in the war in Gaza have led to student clashes with each other, school administrators, and law enforcement. The European Union will provide 1 billion euros in financial aid to Lebanon to prop up the country's economy and help prevent a surge in refugees leaving the country for Europe. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen announced the move this morning following a meeting with Lebanese and Cypriot leaders in Beirut. And Solomon Islands floor makers selected the new prime minister today, choosing Foreign Minister Jeremiah Mannell, who has pledged to continue the Pacific Island nation's foreign policy that draws it closer to China. Mannell called for calm, noting a history of violence in the nation after elections. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thank you, Carlotta. Now it's time for a business news roundup with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Ewan, some words of comfort for markets from the US Federal Reserve.
Yeah, the US central bank has left interest rates on hold for a sixth straight month. This summer was the last time we've got a move in rates. As we came into this year, there was a lot of optimism among investors that we were going to see significant rate cuts over the course of 2024. They thought perhaps there would be four or five interest rate cuts. But the strength of the US economy and the resurgence of inflation has just made that less likely. Fed Chair Jay Powell did have a little bit of hope for investors. He said that he still expected an interest rate cut this year, but markets now think it may be just one or two rather than the several they were expecting before. The problem is there has been a resurgence in inflation. The last 3 months have seen inflation readings above that expected by economists. So inflation is resurgent and the US economy is doing pretty well. The labor market has definitely been softening, but it is not in a bad place. We got data on US job openings yesterday. They fell in March to the lowest level in 3 years. So that's a clear sign of a softening in the labor market. And the so-called quits rate, which measures people who voluntarily left their job, that dropped to just over 2%, which is its lowest level since the summer of 2020. The number of available positions in the US labor market was 8.5 million, just a shade under 8.5 million. If you go back to the post-pandemic labor market spike, that number was above 11 million. So there's been a gradual cooling of the labor market, but it's still in a reasonably good place. And with inflation higher and the GDP growing fairly well, the Fed is just not comfortable about cutting rates. Interesting that some people in the markets think there could actually be a rate hike this year, increasing interest rates to slow inflation. But Fed Chair said he thought that was not his expectation. So that was also reassuring for investors.
And shares in Europe's most valuable company, Novo Nordisk, are lower today despite rapidly increasing sales.
Yeah, so this is a story of the blockbuster weight loss drug Wegovy and also its sister medicine for diabetes, Ozempic. The company Novo Nordisk has increased its forecast, saying that sales could surge as much as 27% this year, operating profit up as much as 30%. But despite the blockbuster numbers, shares it down a little bit. The expectations on this Danish company are just so huge. It shares very highly rated, making it the most valuable company in Europe. It says now that 25,000 patients a week are starting on Wegovy in the US. Another executive has said just a couple of days earlier that the number was 20,000. I think that's a measure of just how fast this metric is rising. Back in December, 5,000 people a week were starting on Wegovy. So it is really ramping up very quickly. But the company is facing pricing pressure and it's facing supply constraints. The latter, broadly, that it can't make enough of this stuff quickly enough. It's actually investing a huge amount of money into production. It says its investment in manufacturing capacity this year will be close to $6.5 billion, and that doesn't include more than $11 billion spent buying up three factories owned by another company. So it's ramping up production very quickly. It is also coming under pressure when it comes to pricing. Senator Bernie Sanders has said that the Senate Committee on Health is investigating the drug's pricing. There was a report a little while ago saying that the drugs could be profitably produced for less than $5 a month. The list price is nearly $1,000. So there is concern about the pricing of these two medicines. The company itself says that 80% of Wegovy patients in the US with commercial coverage for drugs are only paying $25 or less per month. But this has been a huge success, particularly in the US market. And the market, the investors are expecting a lot from Novo Nordisk.
Yeah, generating tons of publicity as well. Incidents like Barbara Streisand earlier in the week accusing Melissa McCarthy of using it in an Instagram comment. Well, Ewan Potts, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. We're heading to Kazakhstan now, where the country has been gripped by a murder trial involving a former government minister, Kwandik Bishimabayev. He is accused of beating his wife, Sultanat Nukanova, to death in the VIP room of a restaurant in the country's largest city, Almaty. The trial has been broadcast, drawing in huge audiences across Kazakhstan and its neighbours, leading to comparisons with O.J. Simpson's so-called trial of the century. The trial has, though, raised serious questions about levels of domestic violence in Kazakhstan, with government data suggesting one in six women experience violence by a male partner. It's also highlighted the excessive privilege some government members enjoy in the justice system. Joining us for more is Almaty-based journalist and author of Dark Shadows Inside the Secret World of Kazakhstan, Joanna Lillis. Joanna, welcome to the programme. Firstly, can you give us a bit more background on the case and the couple involved?
Hi, good afternoon. The couple involved are Kwandik Bishimbayev, as you mentioned, a former minister of the economy in the Kazakh government, and his wife, Sultanat Nukanova. Bishimbayev is accused of having beaten his common-law wife, actually, to death in a public place in a restaurant in the capital, Astana, not the former capital, as you mentioned, late last year. The case has gripped the country, as you mentioned, because there has been shocking evidence presented in court, including visual evidence from videos of Bishimbayev striking his wife, and also audio evidence of him bullying her. So his wife died that night in a public place in a restaurant which is owned by the Bishimbayev family. And Bishimbayev is not only accused of murdering her with particular cruelty, which is a charge in the Kazakh criminal code, but also of covering up the crime, because he didn't immediately report her death. He says that's what he's accused of. He says he did report her death as soon as he realized she had died. Now, the trial is currently drawing to a close in Astana, and there have been many dramatic scenes in the courtroom only today. Several members of the public turned up wearing T-shirts reading slogans for Sultanat and the word life, meaning life imprisonment, demanding life imprisonment, and a request by the defence to have them removed from the courtroom was rejected today by the judge.
And has the huge attention that this case is garnering been handled correctly by the courts? Is there a pressure on the justice system being felt?
Oh, there's enormous pressure on the justice system being felt over this case. Now, Kazakhstan, you know, often comes under fire over the state of its justice system, not least because the political authorities use the justice system in order to jail dissidents, for example. That's what critics say, at least. Now, in this particular case, the government has been extremely eager to make sure that justice is seen to be done. This is a trial which probably in Kazakhstan, there have been very few trials. Probably this is unprecedented in terms of the number of eyes that are on this trial, not only in Kazakhstan, but also internationally. And so the government has tried to make sure that this is seen to be a fair trial. Now, this has been done two particular ways. One is that the trial is being broadcast live, the first time ever in Kazakhstan, so the entire country can tune in, and also other people in the world, of course, to all sessions, all day, every day. And secondly, this is being tried by a jury. Now, that's pretty rare in Kazakhstan, and that's at the defense, the request of the defense. Most trials in Kazakhstan are not jury trials, but this one is being tried by a jury. So this kind of level of transparency is not actually usual in Kazakh trials. But as I say, the government is really eager to make sure that this is seen to be transparent and fair. And certainly, the defense and the prosecution are both, you know, the trial's been extensive. It's been going on for well over a month, and both are getting to have their say in a very public way.
And the defendant was previously a government minister, but he's previously been shown great leniency after being caught up in a corruption case. Do you think, given the mood of the public, that he is going to feel the weight of the law this time if he is found guilty?
Well, we will see that very soon, because the verdict is certainly imminent. I would say that the point that you mentioned, that he was previously shown leniency after being sentenced to 10 years on corruption charges in 2018, and then being released under amnesty after serving just about 18 months of that. Now, that's one of the reasons this trial is attracting so much attention in Kazakhstan, because it's kind of a microcosm of what people see as an unfair system, a corrupt system as well. But an unfair system that accords those who are privileged, you know, undue leniency. Now, in this case, I think because of the attention that the trial is getting, it's hard to imagine that great leniency will be shown. But I wouldn't like to prejudice the verdict or the sentencing in any way. But the pressure of public opinion is such. And it has to be said that the evidence presented in court, which, you know, is very visual, damning evidence. It is not circumstantial evidence. It is evidence of Bishambaev shown to be striking his wife, punching her, dragging her by the hair. I mean, these kind of, and that was at the time.
And he presumably knew that there were cameras and all this was being captured.
Well, that's a sign of impunity, if you like. I mean, he actually he tried to have the cameras wiped in the restaurant, which his family owns, after the event. He says that was because he was afraid of bad publicity, not because he knew that she had died. But, you know, that's a sign of the impunity that we're talking about, that the public is very, very angry about.
And finally, you know, I've mentioned there that the scale of domestic violence in Kazakhstan is sadly shocking. Do you think that this is turning into a cultural Me Too moment? The relatively new leader there, Kasym Jomart Tokayev, came into power in 2019 promising to give women more rights. It is a very traditionally patriarchal society. Is this a moment where sort of women's liberation is really taking hold?
Well, I mean, I think there are many people in Kazakhstan, not just women either, who hope this will be a kind of Me Too moment. And it's looking to some degree as if it might be, because a new law has just been rushed through parliament and quickly signed off by the president, which criminalizes domestic violence and, you know, stiffens up the punishments for domestic violence. It is worth mentioning that back in 2017, domestic violence was actually decriminalized by the government, and people are angry about that, too. We can see that there is action, there is an awareness in the government, in a government which is not always used to taking public opinion into account, it's fair to say, in a country like Kazakhstan, an authoritarian country. There is an awareness that people are very angry, and the force of public opinion is being felt in this trial. And everyone is glued to their computers, watching and waiting for the verdict to see what will happen.
Joanna, hopefully we'll speak to you again when the trial concludes. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, on Tuesday, Ecuador's president, Daniel Noboa, declared a 60-day state of emergency in five coastal provinces due to internal armed conflicts. The police and armed forces will be deployed to the areas to conduct, quote, necessary combat operations against organized armed groups. This marks the second security-based emergency declared by the president since he took office in November, promising to turn around the deteriorating security situation. Joining us for more is Andrew Thompson, journalist and political risk analyst specializing in Latin America. Andrew, thank you for being with us. Why has the president had to declare this emergency now?
Well, I think the main reason is that after a degree of reduction in violence since an uprising in January, things have begun getting worse again. There have been a number of local mayors who have been murdered by criminal groups. And so the president is saying, I have to ramp up the response yet again. However, in a sense, there is an element of, he would like to put across an element of good news, which is that we're not talking about the whole country as we were in January. We're talking about 5 out of 24 provinces, which is a bit more of a more localized or narrow problem in a coastal area of Ecuador, which is basically on the cocaine smuggling route and therefore will attract the attention of the armed criminal organizations more than other parts of the country.
And what can we expect to see from these security forces?
Well, in a sense, the president and the government already has a very large armory of emergency measures. So not only was there a state of emergency declared at the beginning of this year, there was also a state of internal war. And in a referendum held on the 21st of April, just a couple of weeks ago, there was further measures were approved, 9 security measures that gives the government very wide-ranging powers. So in a sense, the debate now isn't about what the government needs to crack down. It's more about how it's conducting that crackdown and how effective it will be. The difficulty, of course, is that when you have criminal organizations linked to international drug cartels, particularly to the Colombian cartels — Colombia lies just to the north of Ecuador — it's very, very difficult to make progress. You may catch a few kingpins, and in fact, in the last week or so, there have been 2 significant arrests of cartel leaders. But the problem with this international dimension is that after you arrest or eliminate some of the kingpins, new people come up and new gangs come up to fill the space they've left. So it's looking like a very difficult challenge for the new president.
And are Ecuadorians generally supportive of the president's approach?
Yes, in a word. The president himself has been getting 70-80% approval ratings, which by Latin American standards is sky high. And in the referendum, there were 11 questions in total that were put to the electorate, 9 of them about crime and security, and 2 about economic issues. So all the 9 questions to do with security were approved. There was a yes vote, again with 60-70% support. The 2 issues to do with the economy, on the other hand, there was a no vote, meaning that the public opinion is supporting Noboa on security and crime, but it is skeptical or unconvinced about his economic proposals. And there is a link, there is a long-term link between the two, because to fight crime, you of course need police and army action, but on the much longer term, you need a lot of social reforms, you need a reduction in poverty, you need to offer young men who become gunmen for the gangs, you need to offer them some kind of economic opportunity. And the pathway towards stronger economic growth and job opportunities under Noboa is not yet clear. He's recently reached an agreement with the International Monetary Fund, but at the moment it looks as if what he is offering on the economic front is basically austerity. He's got a large budget deficit to bring down, and he's taken some unpopular measures, like at the beginning of this month, sorry, the beginning of April, VAT was increased from 12% to 15%. And there is also an expectation that subsidies of energy fuels and so on are going to be reduced, which will be very unpopular. So although the president is enjoying this massive, if you like, wave of popularity, the way ahead is still quite complicated.
And of course, expensive to pay for all of those security forces as well. Andrew Thompson, thank you very much. Well, that music means it's time for our weekly global countdown. And this week we're headed to the Netherlands. Joining us now is Monocle senior correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, we're going Dutch.
We're going Dutch, and I love going to the Netherlands, literally, because it's so fun, it's so upbeat, and you will see why. Shall we start at number 5? This is the type of music that I shouldn't really like, but I do. It's the cover of a classic by Suzy Quatro and Chris Norman, Stumbling It In. We all know the track, but I wonder, what do you feel about this version by the Australian DJ Ciro? Let's have a listen.
Baby, I'll do it for you. Our love is alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's getting grimaces from the gallery here.
Yeah, it's weird. As I said, I shouldn't like, but I am always honest on the show. I'll tell you that, Vinny.
Very good. All right. What's next?
Next, this is a song we played last week, so I'll be very brief, but this song is everywhere. It became viral.
I feel like I've heard this a lot. It's all on the TikToks, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. He's a British producer. I like the song. It's kind of dark pop vibes. It's Artemas with I Like the Way You Kiss Me.
Yeah, I think that one's a win.
It's a win. It's fun. And if you're interested, he's playing New York this coming weekend. I think it's sold out. But, you know, go to resale websites. There's always a way. There's always a way. I'll tell you that. But I think we should spend more time on number three. Not only because he's the Dutch entry for Eurovision this year. Mm-hmm. And he's one of the favorites.
Taking place, of course, next week.
Absolutely.
And you are heading there.
Of course. So maybe next week there'll be a special Global Countdown. Spoiler alert here.
Will you be coming live from Malmo?
Potentially, yes.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I'm very excited because Malmo was also my first Eurovision that I covered for Monaco in 2013. And now it's back to the city, so I'm quite excited. Mm-hmm. And this entry is one of my favorites as well. It's fun. It's a little bit of a celebration of Europe. It's the Dutch rapper Joost Klein with Europa Papa. Ik ben elke dag op reis, want de wereld is van mij. Welkom in Europa, blijf hier tot ik dood ga. Europa, pa, Europa, pa. Welkom in Europa, blijf hier tot ik dood ga. Europa, pa. That is very Dutch and very Eurovision. Very Dutch, and it's a little tribute to happy hardcore, which was a genre in the 90s that the Netherlands was one of the epicenters of it. Mm. So it's kind of retro in that sense. We all like a little bit of Joost Klein here, you know.
And number two?
Number two is a big name in the world of Dutch music. He's not only a musician, a rapper, but he also organized massive events. So he's a businessman too. This is a song, and the video for that song, very expensive. It was in a 5-star hotel in Bangkok. There's a lot of swimming pool, pretty girls and pretty boys maybe. This is Frema with Pretty Girls.
Okay, not what I expected to hear.
I like it. It's kind of a, I don't know.
The sort of Afrobeat trend continuing. We hear that a lot across the Global Countdowns.
Absolutely. And he used to be a member of a rap group from the Netherlands called SFB, but now he's going solo.
Oh. And finally, in at number one.
She's only 19, but again, we're talking about Artemas being viral on social media. It's the same thing with her. Her name is Roxy Dekker. And, you know, I'm glad I translated the track, but first let's have a listen. It's Roxy Dekker with Sugar Daddy. Vanaf ben jij de Benny en ik je sugar daddy. Dus dans een beetje sexy en draai eens met die bil. Want vanaf ben jij de Benny en ik je sugar daddy. Je weet toch Roxy Rover. Roxy is the sugar daddy, that's the big review. And
okay.
I think it's fun, and I am your sugar daddy, so dance a little sexy and turn that buttock. I mean, that's what she's saying.
Okay, and Faye, I have to ask you, are you looking for a sugar daddy to send you to Brazil this weekend to see Madonna?
I am available. I am looking for it. Absolutely. And I'm glad you've mentioned because, yeah, my whole week has been about Madonna.
You've been in a Madonna t-shirt. You've been watching TikToks of the preparations. I mean, just for anyone that doesn't know, can you explain what's going to happen this weekend?
It's historic. Madonna is doing a free gig in Copacabana Beach this coming Saturday. It's expected that 1.5 million people will be there. It's a mega event.
I mean, like Rock in Rio, that was one of the biggest concerts ever, wasn't it? Could this take the record for surpassing?
I think so. The Rolling Stones were there in 2006. I think they have the record, or Paul McCartney. I don't quite remember now, but I think she could be the new queen, literally.
She could be the new queen. She's even been built her own bridge.
Exactly. I mean, she deserves that. I mean, you know, it's Madonna.
Faye, well, we'll see whether you manage to jet to Rio and then to Malmo next week. I think you could do it. I think you can manage it. Well, that's it for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Christy O'Grady. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.